Welcome to the Clinical Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, we are able to make science more accessible and understandable.
All right, welcome everyone to the February 2026 edition of the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Thank you again to our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, for making it possible for us to gather here today. I'm Rimley Crowe, and today I'll be joined by our panelists, Dr. Tony Fernandez, Jeff Rollman, Michael Caduce, and Dr. Bill Toon. As always, our discussion today is going to be paired with an article that's written by our very own columnist, Michael Caduce. It'll be in EMS World called Journal Watch. All of you listening, I encourage you to check out Journal Watch. You can go to emsworld.com under the category of education and training. And to those of you who are here listening live, I want to thank you and remind you, you can use the chat feature on your screen to ask questions, and then we can bring those into the discussion as we go. And without further ado, we are really excited. The article that we are going to be reviewing today is called Do Not Resuscitate Emergency Medical Services Protocol Variation in the United States. This is hot off the press from American Journal of Emergency Medicine. And this paper hits really at the crossroads of things that we care very deeply about in this profession, whether it's pain management, paramedic safety, policy. Let me start that again. The work around hospice and around DNR is something that is so important in our field and that we, at least I in EMT school, didn't get to learn a whole lot about. So I am very excited to welcome experts in this space with us, the authors of this paper, Dr. Amelia Breyer and Dr. Satish Gunaga. Thank you for taking the time and joining us today.
Thank you, Remlin.
Before we dive into this complex, operationally sometimes complicated, incredibly important topic of DNRs, I think it would be great if we could start off with some introductions for the audience. So if you'll just tell us who you are, what you do, and then I always like to know, how did you get into EMS research? So I'll start with you, Dr. Breyer.
Hi. Yes. So it's always kind of been a passion of mine is care for patients near the end of life. I think it's just one of the biggest privileges one has as an EMS clinician is kind of being there and being present, kind of witnessing that transition at the end of life. And so I think there's just so much meaning in it. And it's just one of those things that EMS training and the EMS culture and philosophy has not been designed to do well. You know, very traditionally, EMS is about transporting and resuscitating, and it's a big paradigm and cultural shift, but really, really kind of important one.
Definitely an important one. Thank you for joining us. And Dr. Gunaga.
Yeah. Hey, guys. My name is Satish Gunaga. I'm an emergency medicine physician based out of Henry Ford Health and Michigan State University Health Sciences, so in the Detroit area. I in a past life, I had the honor to work the road as a paramedic and critical care paramedic, and I'm a non-boarded EMS physician medical director in Wayne County, but continue to hold my paramedic license and very much interested, like Amelia, in the intersection between end-of-life care, hospice and palliative patients, and both the ED and specifically in the out-of-hospital or EMS arenas.
Love paramedics who become researchers.
Awesome. And then, yeah, honored to join you guys here today. Really appreciate the invitation and for you featuring our paper.
Oh, yeah, we're excited and we're grateful that you've taken the time to share with us. And we kind of hinted at the objective of this study to look at the differences in variation in protocols. But I'm curious, you know, if there's something that drew you to studying DNR protocol variation in EMS specifically, was there a clinical case or systems experience that brought you to this research question?
Amelia, you want me to get us started or would you like to?
Oh, sure. I'll take a first pass at it, and you have
Please.
it add on. All the time, especially kind of as even direct medical control. Like it's one of those things that comes up all the time. Was this out of state pulsed valid? Is this picture, photograph, Xerox copy of a pulsed or DNR form valid? How about this? And it's an area that is. Just filled with challenge for the EMS clinicians and the families who are kind of in these challenging predicaments. So yes, it's definitely something that comes up, I think, on a regular basis.
Yep, and I agree with Amelia. And, I lived this when I worked the road as a paramedic, and I live it now as an emergency medicine physician. We continue to kind of encounter this existential crisis where essentially a patient and family, they're very clear about what they want, but they don't have the paperwork to support it. And then it puts us all in this very awkward situation on how to respond and to deal with those situations. So out of hospital is uniquely challenging as well.
Absolutely. And I am going to invite Dr. Tony Fernandez, one of our panelists. So we want to talk through some of the methodology on how were you able to assess protocols? We have this refrain, which I'm not a big fan of, that if you've seen one EMS system, you've seen one EMS system. But in this case, there does appear to be a lot of variation. And sometimes even gathering those kinds of protocols can be really challenging, especially when not all states use statewide protocols. So, Tony, I'll turn it over to you and let's explore a little bit of the methodology before we hop into the results.
Well, great. Excuse me. And thank you again for joining us today. I think this is a really important paper to let us kind of level set where we are in EMS. And this is not easy work, and I'm glad that you guys did it. So can you talk to us a little bit about, so this was a cross-sectional structured review, and you didn't just look at a handful of states like some might do in regions or stuff. You looked not only just in the United States and the 50 states, but cities and some in Canada. Can you walk us through kind of how you casted this really broad, wide net?
I'll get started, Amelia, if that's okay. Dr. Fernandez, I think you're well aware there's a lot of literature recently around these type of national protocol reviews. And some are written really well and some maybe have some room for improvement. And so we had the opportunity to look at what we thought were a couple of the gold standard examples of this methodology. And one thing that we thought was really important is we wanted to reflect the whole country. So if we just looked at statewide protocols, not every state has statewide protocols. And if we were just looking for accessible online protocols, not everyone is posting them online. So we had seen some other papers that had used some expanded methodology to capture the 50 most populous cities, which essentially got us up to, and correct me if I'm wrong, Amelia, about 44 of the 51 territories we were looking to capture. And we thought that that would be representative. Now we still are missing out on areas, areas within our paper that are, potentially neglected are our rural critical access EMS counties, other counties that don't publicly share their protocols. But we did feel like with this methodology, doing the 50 states as well as the 50 most populous cities, it casted the greatest net for us to give some generalizable statement at the end of the paper.
Yeah, no, that's great. And that's a lot of work to do that. And just kind of diving in a little bit more to the amount of work that goes into this. So you didn't just you mentioned that there was this website that was really useful to your study. It was emsprotocols.org. But that is not only what you did. You looked you looked at websites yourself, and when you couldn't find things, you actually made some outreach phone calls. Can you talk to us about some of that and how each of these steps filled in some missing data sections?
Yes, certainly the vast majority were obtained through EMS protocol. It is, a great resource in that way. But yeah, to get the more accurate or kind of larger view, there's a lot that's missing from there, certainly. So that's why we kind of went through those extra steps, looking from a looking at the larger cities. A lot of it was just kind of, looking at government websites, and then reaching out when possible. Certainly, not every agency responded, not every city did, but trying to get, closer to a better snap snapshot of the US and how things currently stand.
Yeah, that's great. And what did you find in some of these when you were looking at some of these protocols? Were they all, did you feel like they were all the things that were posted online were pretty up to date, or were there things you're like, nope, this is decades old? And how did the conversations with the phone calls you make, how did those go?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a combination of both, Dr. Fernandez. So, we saw a great amount of variety in the different type of protocols, and I think we'll talk about that in a moment when we get to the results. We found some of these protocols were barely a half a page, and some are like 6, 7 pages long with a great amount of detail and examples of documents that are accepted and not accepted. One of our co-authors, Dr. David Yang, he's actually helped really develop this methodology, has conducted it along other questions as well, and had created a kind of a invoice of, or like a log of different people we could contact with states and agencies. And we did get some responses back, and we did get, some updates as simple as, no, we don't have a protocol, or yep, here's our protocol. I think, like Amelia said, I think by, it was one thing to just go and see what's publicly accessible, but we thought that that would offer, some bias of just what's available and not looking at what's unavailable. So we wanted to try to go that extra step to fill the gap and get a more accurate snapshot.
Yeah, I think that that's work well done because, as you said, there's a lot of things that, and hopefully this can inform some folks and maybe they can make their protocols more publicly available. I think that this is just a really important study. So, just into the nitty-gritty a little bit. So, this was your review period was July to November of 2024. is there was this was there a reason for this other than this is what worked for all the co-authors, or why did to talk to my let me give you a little background of why I'm asking this question. A lot of our audience are kind of some new researchers, folks who are trying to get into the field and trying to understand that what research is. And I really want them to understand that, there are some times where a study period is picked because this is important to the question. And we need it to be this specific time period. And there are some times where a study period is picked because, look, this is what works. And sometimes, the perfect doesn't have to be the enemy of the good. So, can you tell us where your study fits in that spectrum?
I will say that two of our co-authors were our EMTs themselves, and it was for them a first foray into research, and really a great
Love it.
opportunity to do so. So they were primarily extractors of the data. So they, in reviewing the protocols, were the ones who coded our findings. And so at least their summer hours tended to overlap with that. So it was really just a function of availability and. I think what I hope was a good opportunity for them. So, it was great having that perspective.
Yeah, and I agree with Amelia. And Tony, you make a great point here too, because, something that I learned as we conducted this study, our snapshot only represents during the period that we looked. So though the paper was published here more recently in 2025, essentially all our paper can comment is was what was the snapshot between July and I think November of 2024. So that's an important point, Dr. Fernandez, because essentially, what we can't tell you is what the snapshot looks like today, but we can tell you what it looked like in that window in 2024, and that's an important takeaway from this paper as well.
That is great. And that's exactly what I was hoping you'd get to. So thank you very much for that. So research is not always the easiest thing in the world. And particularly something like this when where you're kind of searching for things and sometimes you just don't know where to search, kind of, reaching in the dark. Can you give me one or two things that you thought were harder than you might have anticipated they'd be going in, and maybe one or two where you thought this is going to be difficult, and maybe it surprised you that it wasn't.
Amelia, I'll start with some thoughts here. So, obviously, anytime you take on any project, you got to be really organized. Lucky to have people like Amelia and Dr. Wang on our team because they're just such good project leaders. Then you really kind of have to lay out roles. And there's no doubt that the most time-intensive role was the data abstraction by Dr. By Merkel and Jagani, the other co-authors on this paper. And so once we kind of got through that abstraction process, got them through the education, troubleshooting what was what, and based on our definitions, we had a ton of data. And then what was really interesting, the writing didn't come too far away, but at the very end, there was a lot of sorting out some dis inconsistencies, that, for example, certain counties had identical protocols. Well, then, are we really looking at two different protocols, or are we looking just for one protocol that's covering multiple counties and we needed to adjust for that? Sometimes, like any Excel form, you can't tell what was the real answer here, and we'd have to go back and dive in and double check some of our work. But honestly, I thought, and Amelia, please comment, I thought this project went really smoothly, streamlined, and I really liked the methodology that we used to approach it.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I will say one of the limitations of kind of and challenges is DNR and Pulse in particular. This kind of space is not just for EMS. A lot of this might be in state regulation or legislation, and so there should ideally be matching of the state protocols with what might be codified in state law or regulation, but. And not always. So, there potential for things we might have kind of missed, and kind of it creates some challenges. DNR and Pulse, for that matter, are meant, for a variety of specialties and a variety of care settings. And so, understanding that EMS is part of that and a very important intended part, but putting that context into this research in particular was kind of important.
That's fantastic. So I always have, excuse me. I typically have the unenviable task of holding us up to make sure we get all the methods in before we get into the really interesting results. So just before we do dive into the results that are really so important, I do want to open this up to some of our other panelists who may have some methods related questions. And again, I really want to thank you for joining us today to discuss your work.
Absolutely. I have one methods question, and this comes up a lot in research where we're doing abstraction. It's the concept of inter-rater reliability. So if I go out and gather all the protocols and come up with Remley's list, and then Tony goes out and comes up with Tony's list, it's quite possible we'll have some differences. But in your case, I was really impressed to read that you had a kappa, which is a measure of how often reviewers agree, of 0.99, which is incredibly high. I'm curious what you all did to help make sure these definitions were commonly understood by the members of your research team to get such a high kappa.
That's a great question, Remley. So, I want to give kudos to Dr. Yang here because there's no doubt in order to get quality abstraction, you need good training that's uniform to both abstractors. And that's where Dr. Yang really kind of started this process. He met with both abstractors, laid out the definitions, and then even formally went through two, maybe even three statewide protocols that we had already identified as confusing. And then went through and had them abstract, answered questions. And then we did our kappa analysis on the front end. And, Amelia, fact check my number. I think we kappa'd six cases or six protocols. But then we let the abstractors run for six. And then we paused to see that there was congruence and that there was inter-rater reliability. And as you just d demonstrated, they were spot on for the ones they did in duplicate. And then we let them go. At that point, we had felt that the training was sufficient, that there was inter-rater reliability, and the remaining abstracts were not done in duplicate anymore.
With some role for adjudication at the end too, because there were certainly
Yes.
some things that were a little, confusing. And so if there were, they were flagged and brought back to kind of especially the senior EMS physicians to discuss and adjudicate.
Yeah, no, thanks, Amanda. That's a key piece too at the end.
Having that adjudication process is always critical, and having the odd number of people involved so that we can get to a consensus, I think, is key. And I'm really excited about that method that Dr. Yang had developed because it is really challenging to do this kind of abstraction. So having a roadmap for how to do it when we want to look at this again in a few years and see, hey, has the education, obviously this podcast dissemination, help people rethink about how we do DNR protocols in EMS. And so we want to get into the results, but one more thing that I want to talk about is terminology. And you kind of hinted at this, Amelia, that we don't really have a common vocabulary. And in table one of the paper, there's a lot of the different terminologies that are thrown out around this concept. And I'd add others. I think even the terms palliative care, comfort care, all of these things come flying in here. This is an opportunity. Do you all have some advice or some concepts of things where you think we should try to unite the terminology on this? Or is it we just need to be aware of all the things that are out there and get used to it?
Gosh, this is a topic in particular that I feel passionately about. The term DNR unto itself, it's shortly developed after CPR was developed. So, it's several decades old, and it's just not accurate, but obviously something that we all know, right? Do not resuscitate is not really, it's really do not attempt resuscitation. And even then, that's not a guarantee of success. There's a shift kind of in hospice and palliative medicine to use the preferred term is actually allow natural death. It's really emphasizing what you're permitting and not necessarily, withholding. So kind of using either those phrases, do not attempt resuscitation, DNAR, or allow natural death, AND, are one of the things we actually looked for even within the methods to see if those that language was being introduced as a really emphasizing that paradigm shift in focus and in kind of allowing a natural process. So there's that aspect of terminology, and then there is yes the wild world of advanced care planning documentation and the variety that comes with it. There is just so many options out there and that might or might not be permitted. And maybe I'll start by saying I think the most valuable one for EMS without doubt is the portable medical orders. So that is your pulsed. In some cases it's a MULST. All 50 states have some version of this. Not all of it is codified in EMS protocol, as we as we kind of learned through our paper, but that is really a medical order, and it's really designed, for EMS clinicians in mind, as kind of an end user. So, really emphasizing that that's kind of the best one to use. Advanced directives, living wills, those are legal documents. Those are in a safe somewhere. They might not be easy to access, especially when you need them, in moments of emergency or acute crisis. So those are a little bit more challenging, I think, to use for EMS, for medicine in general. And then happy to kind of talk maybe a little bit more of the jewelry as well. That's kind of another possibility, especially for older populations who might not want tech solutions. Jewelry is one of the things that is very portable. It's very, simple and kind of easy to recognize. Most states that do ha allow jewelry have specific jewelry companies that are, that they're approved, and they actually kind of have the backup confirmatory like number that you can call on their jewelry.
So no friendship bracelet DNR.
I mean,
There's a business idea there somewhere, I am
I like
sure.
it. I like the more colorful version. I think that's that can go far.
Exactly, a little sparkle. Nothing wrong with that. For me, this table was actually one of the first like wake up calls in the paper. I was like, oh my gosh, there's a lot of different types of documents and a lot of different types of terminology. And as a field EMT, I'm not sure that this was ever part of my curriculum where I skipped that page in the textbook and I didn't fortunately think about it too often, but that comes at a great disadvantage when we do encounter a patient where an AND or a DNR becomes a potential thing that they would want, right? So I appreciated the clarifying this right out of the gate. And I know that we'll spend the rest of the time talking through the results and the differences in protocols that you all saw, but this is very helpful laying the groundwork, I feel.
Yeah, Remley, if I may add too, I also love this table. I thought it would give great clarity. And this gap in knowledge is not unique just to EMS clinicians. This gap is multidisciplinary. You can ask a bunch of ER docs and nurses, and they would be confused about this terminology as well. So I just wanted, I think Amelia would say the same, that this is not just a unique issue to EMS. I think around our whole specialty, the clarity around these documents and what they mean and how they work is there's some confusion around it.
Absolutely. And we've got some panelist questions. We'll go Jeff and then Bill.
First off, just want to commend both of y'all on this excellent work, excellent study, and just so thoughtful. For example, including this table one of definitions, really great. And then the supplement, where you included your actual questions in the key was great. But was wondering a little bit about the logistics of this study, because I know you mentioned the emsprotocols.org website that you went to gather protocols, and it lists a ton of different agencies, which is awesome, but something like maybe only a quarter or less are actually on there. So I saw, and you briefly mentioned direct outreach. Was wondering how that worked out, if you were calling or emailing these agencies. Were you pretty successful, or were you and the other co-authors and researchers kind of spinning your wheels, spending hours and hours on end? Because I know I've sometimes struggled to just get a hold of these protocols. So, how did that all work out?
If Dr. Yang was here, he'd tell you truly the pains that were involved in that process, Dr. Ullman. But yeah, it was a combination of he had done this type of protocol national survey before. So he had contact information already in places where protocols were not available on emsprotocol.org. And so those were individuals that he had had some success reaching. Otherwise, we were sending kind of random emails or calls to phone numbers, not getting replies. I think even Amelia, fact check me here. I think we even sent a letter out to one because that's what the process that Dr. Yang had used before to try to reach that municipality. So it was complicated, Dr. Wollman, but ultimately, we created a fixed point. How many phone calls or emails or attempts till no reply, and then we stopped. And so in that way, we knew that once we reached this point, we weren't going to get it. And I think it's important, though we attempted to look at all 50 states and attempted to look at all 50 most populous cities, we didn't hit that mark. And I think we'll talk about that in a moment when we go through the results.
Absolutely. Dr. Tune.
I'll echo thank you. Exciting. Two things come to mind. One is I appreciate your very early comment or definition that you mentioned is that how this is actually handled in the field or the ED and how challenging it is and how inconsistent it is. And I know that, throughout my career, I got better at it, but I always found some way to try to honor the family's wishes as much as possible. Separate of that, I would be interested to know, did you compare anything that you found related to any of the current textbooks or national standard curriculums related to this topic area to what you found? And the one comment Remley said is the reason it may not have been covered in educational things, it's so different, not only state to state, but sometimes county to county and community to community, that educators will choose not to cover it, or what's in the books may be just very superficial. Thoughts on that?
Agree with you. I think you nailed it, Bill. Like, it's so variable as the paper is describing, but even within one state, one county might handle it differently than the next, right next door. And so I think in that capacity, that might be why some of this is absent with clarity in our EMS textbooks. But Amelia, what are your thoughts there? Do you have a feel?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think that does, pose some a challenge in some ways. One of the things we did kind of in the literature review in before doing this, was we did find identified actually two different papers that did like nationwide. One first one was a telephone survey that looked at a national kind of sample again, and they only found eight DNR orders that were accepted. And this is in 1991. And then in 1999, they kind of did a repeat, and at that point, there were 34 states that had adopted. That was more of a regulation review. And I think one of the things that's kind of just evolved, since then is the development of Pulsed. And there's a lot of evolution, I think, in this field too. Much the same way EMS has changed, so has kind of end of life care. And so it is a, I wouldn't, not a rapidly moving target, but I do think there has been, changes and updates in terms of how Pulsed and Most works. There's electronic registries that exist in some states, like Portland, sorry, Oregon. And so those are kind of just important considerations that have, evolved over the years recently, and kind of affect the use of these forms.
Yeah, and I'll just follow real quickly here too, Bill. We did do, there's a sister paper associated with this paper. And it was published as well. And it was published in Pre-Hospital Emergency Care, just recently at the end of the year. And it was us duplicating this methodology, time to identify all the hospice and palliative care protocols that exist at a national level, 50 most popular, 50 states, 50 most populous cities. And there we did start to look into textbooks and look for standardized NAEMS protocol recommendations. And you can find that on that side of the literature.
I can't wait to dig in a little bit on that side as well, because I hinted I'm a little bit of a pain management nerd, and I love talking about the intersection of these things. But to highlight the results of this study first, you ended up reviewing 64 unique protocols, and 84% of those had some dedicated language around DNR. So first of all, I'm curious just your reactions. Were you surprised that not all EMS systems had a formal DNR protocol?
Yes.
Yes, definitely.
I'm curious what you think that means also for the operational implications, what may be happening without this in place.
Yeah, look, I think there's a lot of discordant care. That's a term we use. People are receiving care that they did not want. And then I think you also have a lot of EMS clinicians, paramedics, basics, etc., living in this existential moment where they know they're providing care that this patient doesn't want, but they don't have the guidelines or protocol support, to be more goal, consistent. So it surprised me. And you know what, Amelia and I had mentioned before, there's these older papers from the 1990s, but this hadn't been, we were surprised it hadn't really been revisited again. And so we were happy to see at least 84% had them. But we had actually thought that this number would look even larger than that. So a little surprised.
Absolutely. And within the 84% that did have a DNR protocol, you observed a lot of variation. And depending on, we talked about that table one containing the different types of documents that may or may not be honored, or the types of ways of communicating DNR. Pulsed, which Amelia, you mentioned earlier, was the highest marked as an accepted form of communication of a DNR wish at 76%, followed by jewelry, advanced directives, and living wills. I'm curious again around your thoughts on Pulsed and why this may have the highest acceptance, or what makes this the most actionable from a pre-hospital standpoint.
I am unabashedly team Pulsed too. So let that be known. I just think it's a fantastic document, and really it's just so powerful. It documents a conversation that patients have had, with their physicians. But it's also designed for EMS in mind. And that's kind of a really the whole origin of the Pulsed is that it was invented originally in Oregon as a combination of ethicists and EMS leadership who kind of came together. And so it's designed with the end user being EMS in mind, and under kind of understanding that the portability is kind of so important, and acknowledging that it's a medical order. I think that's why it has that benefit, that not only is from a DNR really means if someone has no pulse and is not breathing, that's the only time a DNR actually applies. If they have a pulse and if they are breathing, even if they are at the end of life, There is that other section within the pulse that says what types of intervention someone would like. So if someone is in hospice and they are breathing and they have a pulse, DNR no or does not apply. It's really the second section because they want comfort focus treatment, and I think that is a real added benefit of the pulse operationally is that it has that section and can really help guide care and the intensity of care. And even transportation for these patients. So, that's kind of why I'm so biased.
And a good reason that hits a lot of important points, especially around the individualized use, right? Not all DNRs mean the same thing, and you can specify the specific wishes in those documents. So I'm also Team Pulsed, and I will turn it to Michael for another question.
One thing that first, thank you for this great research. Really enjoyed reading the paper, and the more we can get on this topic, the better as we move it forward. One of the things that oftentimes comes up in our operation is folks that maybe have a DNR tattoo or something like tattooed on their chest that says "Do not resuscitate." While I recognize it's fairly rare, there are some states that I have heard do legally accept that. I don't know if that's true or not, but just wondered if you happen to come across anything like that outside of the just general jewelry that someone might wear.
There is a famous like New England Journal case report that was kind of the photo of a gentleman who had "Do not resuscitate" across his chest, I think the outcome of that or the discussion on that case report is that they did resuscitate him since it wasn't kind of an officially approved advanced care document. However, after a few days in the ICU, ultimately it was decided by the ethics committee that this was an individual whose wishes were clear. Someone who very much was so committed to allowing for a natural death that that was truly his stated wishes, and so care was withdrawn to better align with the patient's wishes. I don't think that tattoos are quite ready for prime time in EMS, and I don't think they are should be a routinely accepted way of documenting DNR. However, I think it makes for an interesting case report for sure. The pulsed, just preferably the pulsed.
They just need the whole form tattooed. I get it.
Yeah,
That
there you
makes
go.
sense. But I think a
Oh, yeah.
very interesting concept of there, it only goes to echo the fact that there's not a lot of uniformity here, that there seems to just be this continuation where what one agency or state or city allows is much different if you just literally cross territories. I wondered if you found anything. I know there are agencies and states that are moving to online registries for advanced directives. Did you note any of that coming up? And that's my only other question in terms of in your research.
Just so much yes. That is the way, the biggest operational challenges of a lot of these, DNR documentations is the availability and accessibility when you need it most. I think as much as, families and patients are primed to, no one really wants to have like their pulse on the fridge. In nursing homes, paperwork seems to get lost sometimes. It's the darnest thing. So having pulsed registries in particular are so valuable, allowing these documents to really follow patients through their, healthcare journeys, from home to the emergency room back home, is really ideal. And I think, electronic registries, even integrated with kind of health information exchanges is the way to accomplish this. I think California, the state that I'm currently in, is working actively on developing an ePulse registry, largely kind of inspired by the work that I think in Oregon that's been successful. But there's more coming for sure.
Great to hear it. And also being in California, that was what prompted the question. So thank you for your great research.
A lot of California questions. There's also some discussion in the chat around when patients and the public expect access to a pulse and a in to use it, but that's not always happening, and responders may not be able to do so legally and practically, and so that tension still exists. And do you have thoughts on whether there are things that we can do to help ease that disconnect and make sure that we are able to honor patients' wishes?
I The verbal DNR, you can see the last kind of item we talked about here on in terms of looking at as part of the analysis, is a just very powerful protocol. It's really the ability to accept if there's family on scene that seems reliable, and for whatever reason they cannot access their documented documentation that it's accepted by EMS clinicians. And I think within the paper, actually, we referenced in particular Washington State had a quote of a verbal DNR that I just thought was a very nice and just kind of very well done language that I was actually kind of hoping to adopt here in San Francisco, where I'm the EMS agency medical director. Just basically allowing if a patient looks like they might have a terminal illness, something that I think every EMS clinician has a general, gestalt of, and there's reliable scene family on scene, that a verbal DNR is acceptable. And that just feels right. I think there's, we did it actually as part of the little bit of background, did a review of case law wise to see if there were any lawsuits or kind of active challenges with verbal DNRs. And we couldn't find any cases in scenarios where verbal DNRs were permitted. It's not like that it resulted in any lawsuits. However, the inverse was true. There were cases of wrongful death, sorry, wrongful life, whereby patients were resuscitated, against their preferences or against the preferences of their families, and that can certainly result in some legal challenges.
You've hit on two of the things I was hoping to bring into this conversation, actually. The verbal DNR being one that seems potentially more both ethically and operationally fraught with challenges. And as a medical director and as physicians, what are some of the safeguards that you would want to put in place in a protocol around honoring a verbal DNR to ensure that you're, I think as an EMT, before coming into research and reading these kinds of papers, my supposition would be it's safer just to go ahead and resuscitate if I'm unsure. But how do we put the safeguards in place that I could feel confident that this is the right thing?
Amelia, I'm going to defer this one to you. I'm interested in your answer here.
I think this is just the art and the science of medicine, whether that be pre-hospital or in the emergency room. I think just sometimes you can walk into a room and you see a patient and you just know what the right thing is. Especially for patients who are diagnosed with a terminal illness, who are near the end of life. That just feeling when you walk in and you're like, this is not a resuscitation that should happen. Just trusting your gut and that instinct, and now having a protocol that kind of supports you, knowing that, your EMS medical director trusts your opinion, kind of empowers you as a medic, as an EMT, that your vibes on this were correct. There's family there, rather than going against the wishes of family and transporting this patient, and kind of doing what doesn't feel right. This a verbal DNR just kind of reinforces that scenario, and is really meant to kind of empower EMS clinicians in those moments. And certainly, though, if there's any confusion, if there's any discord, if there's one family member who says, resuscitate, and one who doesn't, then that's a great opportunity to either call an EMS physician, call your base hospital, or transport. That is not what this is intended for. Those are, if there's any ethical challenges or areas of gray, that's not what the verbal DNR is meant for.
Absolutely. And I think that's important consideration because we like to make things into nice and neat protocols, but sometimes those on-scene situations are definitely more blurry, if you will.
Yeah, and Remley, I want to make one addition here too. From an emergency medicine perspective, I'm regularly creating verbal DNRs. Like we're in the ED, we're talking to patients. We go through some goals of care. We define this, and they verbally tell me what they want. We're also kind of verbally taking, DNRs or goals of care, decisions from family without them showing me that they are the designated healthcare proxy. So this isn't unknown territory. We regularly traverse this territory in the ED. And I think from a med mal perspective, if you're being fooled as an EMS clinician by someone on scene about the advanced directives, you will not be held liable for that, right? If there is someone on scene trying to trick you, which I would be the exception, then, I don't think we need to worry about that level of safeguard right now. I think the truth is, death is such a sacred moment. The people who are usually around at the moment of death, they mean a lot to these individuals. They're there for a reason, and they're advocates for them in that moment. So.
Right. Maybe what we see on forensic files is the exception, not the rules. And Jeff, I see you've got a question.
Yes, yeah. I was just wondering on the topic of verbal DNRs, which we've been discussing. I was very surprised to see that only six of the protocols that you found require that DMO contact. So I believe that's the online calling the EMS medical director or medical control. And I thought it would have been much more. I mean, I guess I'm a little biased to my current system in San Antonio. That is a requirement if there's not a valid written DNR. But that was something I thought surprising. I was wondering if you were surprised by that as well. And then sort of the implications, both of you as EMS medical directors, is this something that you think of, hey, we should be involved? That kind of helps from a liability standpoint. Or at the same time, you might be thinking, I don't want to be involved. Because I know there are definitely EMS clinicians who, if something requires a mandatory contact, they're not going to necessarily do that. Or there could be a delay or problems getting a hold of you that I could also see the opposite side of not wanting that. So I was just wondering your thoughts and reaction to that.
That's a great question. And I was also initially kind of surprised at that number and took a little deeper dive into the actual text that was in support of or against. And in particular, I think that the caveat here was the explicitly allows from a healthcare provider kind of bumped up those numbers. So there was some overlap, not only requires DMO contact, but a lot of scenarios whereby they said, like, for a patient that was in a nursing facility, for example, and there was a physician there who was like, DNR, that was accepted, and that was considered a verbal DNR. And so I think that was probably a more comfortable area. And so I think that's why this number kind of looks a little bit higher, even than the yeah the, than I expected it to. kind of to your point though about like areas of liability and what that kind of feels like. I think the verbal DNR is really intended for this very unique patient population. That is very much, seriously ill, with a terminal diagnosis. Those hospice patients, for example, is a real prime example where it just, it feels right to allow a natural death. And I think, separate to this paper is really the training burden, though, that would come out, that would have to be part of the process in operationalizing this. Because I think, as Remley kind of opened up and talked about this topic as something that wasn't really addressed, as as part of like EMT school or, continuing educations even, it has a lot to do with communications training, right? Like this is not, I think a lot of physicians have goals of care discussions, and I think EMS clinicians are very capable of having goals of care clarifications. Just confirming that, like, this is a DNR. It sounds like this pulse wants to, really emphasize comfort-focused treatment. Is that correct? And really, how do you leverage these documents to confirm that this is what the patient wants and provide that goal concordant care? And it's just sometimes that little turn of phrase, right? It's the, do you want everything done? Oh gosh, who's gonna say who? Yes, of course, it's my loved one. That's not a fair question. Do you want to allow a natural death? Is that this is what this document is saying? When you phrase it that way, I think it changes the conversation, and that is communications training, and that is something that is part of kind of better implementing these protocols needs to accompany it. Because just like any procedure, communication skills are skills, and so some people, you need to practice them and you need to hone them.
I love that highlight. The communications training is absolutely key. And I got ahead of myself earlier in the introduction because I know you do so much work in this space, and I'm also very passionate about palliative pain management and hospice care. And it's striking to me the parallels with this work in the sister paper that a lot of these resuscitation dilemmas, if you were, happen because EMS may be inappropriately activated. and you've done some work around activations in hospice, and too often we're exchanging business cards on game day. And I'm curious if you have some tips or things that have come out of your research in terms of how EMS systems could partner more effectively with hospice agencies so that 911 isn't being summoned when resuscitation isn't actually desired or appropriate, or how can we be better partners in the community ahead of time so that we don't encounter these situations?
That's a wonderful question, Remley, and I know Amelia can speak to this quite a bit because she's been a part of initiations of hospice and palliative protocols in jurisdictions that she's been in before. We just initiated a hospice and palliative care EMS protocol in Wayne County, so large area, 19th largest county in the country, and it took a minute, and it took some real buy-in from our local, EMS clinicians and chiefs, and we needed to meet with our hospice agencies because each little area has different hospice agencies and they do stuff differently. But at the heart of this, I think what we recognize is that a lot of people who are under hospice or palliative or have advanced directives or DNARs, the reason 911 is initiated, it can be for a lot of reasons, but often it's fear. And it's fear by a loved one who is just frightened by the situation. Normally, EMS is just programmed to come in and assess and resuscitate and transport, but just taking a pause. A lot of what these family members need is just reassurance that whatever's going on scene is natural. And then I think the real moneymaker, at least in the hospice palliative care protocol, is allowing the clinic, the EMS team, to contact the hospice team directly by phone. And often, once they get a hold of the hospice team, they have a relationship with the family. The hospice team can start to de-escalate things, verify goals, and then just having an option to do limited trials on scene where the paramedics can take, I'm not talking about an hour trial, 10, 15 minutes just to give some nausea meds or assist giving some home meds. Get on phone with the hospice nurse. I think these are the moments to kind of de-escalate and avoid unnecessary or unwanted transports or care. Amelia, your thoughts there?
No, that was well said.
And perhaps, Amelia, you can share your experience. I know you did a quality improvement project around reducing unnecessary EMS contacts and for patients in hospice. And what were some of the things that you found that worked really well that maybe other systems would want to consider implementing?
I was initially part of a community paramedicine project in Ventura County, whereby there were hospice community paramedics. And one of the things that they did as part of this program rollout was allow a local optional scope of practice expansion, whereby the medics could use medications from hospice emergency kits. That was a nice addition. However, in the 534 hospice patients that were evaluated, the kit was only used once. It kind of really speaks to it was for haloperidol. It really speaks to the power of communication, and that's really what is at the strength of EMS in these scenarios is the ability to address these concerns and these fears. I think I've done some qualitative studies as well, and I think it's frustrating for like medics and EMTs who respond to these calls, and it's like, you're in hospice, why did you call? Like, this is what do you want us to do? And it's I think understanding in a lot of these situations, it's the number that patients and their families know best, and they're just really afraid. They don't want to see their loved one in pain, and how do you talk through that, and what do you do next, is kind of a really is the skill and is the art part of the medicine. Pain control kind of being a big thing, symptom control in particular.
Absolutely. And I think that intersection between this is so important to highlight and to plan a system, in addition to just an isolated protocol in a silo. This really does take a system to be successful. And now I know I have the unpopular task of keeping us on time. And so we are nearing the end, but I do want to give you all an opportunity to have some last words for our audience, some key takeaways, or you know, something that you would want every agency leader or medical director to hear or to go out and do after this when it comes to any of the things that we've discussed today, whether that's, you know, getting pulse for members of your community. What takeaway would you leave our audience with, or a charge to action, if you will?
From my perspective, the pulsed, just consider if it's not documented or part of your protocols, really emphasizing that, and what an opportunity in doing so to emphasize training around that and how to use it and leverage it in these situations. And then consider, you know, if in your system, if it's right for you, the use of a verbal DNR, because it really is kind of a powerful tool that can really you know, empower EMS clinicians.
Well
Yeah.
said.
And Remley, I just echo Amelia. I'm also team pulsed. I'm also team verbal DNR. We tried to actually create that process in Michigan, or at least in Wayne County, but we were locked up because we're really, you have to defer to the state statute. It's the statute that will determine, you can't deviate locally your protocol from the statute. So until the state makes the opportunity for verbal DNR to be available, it was not. And if that's not available, reaching out, I think journals like DMO, right, direct medical oversight, or but just calling your base hospital, looking for medical control, touching base, with the ED team for assistance, I think can be really valuable as well.
Extraordinarily valuable. And I thank you. This has certainly sparked a lot of great discussion and discussion in our chat as well, especially around the discordance sometimes between statute and what we would want to do in protocols. I want to extend a huge thank you again to both of you for, one, taking on this work. It wasn't small. We know that. And for advancing the national conversation on how, as pre-hospital clinicians, we operationalize end-of-life care to best meet our patients' needs and desires. So thank you again for taking the time to share your work with us. And we look forward to reading the next papers.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Remley. I think so highly of this podcast and the work you guys do here. So thank you for everything that you lead.
Oh, we absolutely appreciate it. And I've got the unpopular task of carrying us out. But I do, before I go, want to remind our listeners that the education version of the Research Journal Club podcast will be Friday, February 27th. We'll be back here again with another clinical episode of the Journal Club podcast, second Monday of every month. That should be, if I've done my math correctly, March 9th at noon Central. I want to thank you all for listening again. Thanks for the conversation and the chat. Let's keep it going on social media. I could geek out about this and all kinds of things all day. So thank you for allowing us to nerd out, and I look forward to seeing you all next month.
We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at pcrfpodcast.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website, prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsors, Limmer Education, providing educational tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey, and ESO, dedicated to improving community health and safety through the power of data.